rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome one, welcome all to The Ruck from The Times and Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher, and today, look how lucky you all are. We've assembled a crack panel to review the opening round of the Six Nations. Forget the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. This man has been the gem of home nations rugby journalism for practically as long. Welcome to Stephen Jones, rugby correspondent for The Sunday Times. How are you, Steve?
Not so bad, thank you. A little bit jaded.
Yeah, and second, we have the man who's changed the scrum laws for the tournament. After a searing exclusive led to the glory of the breakfoot, and we thank him kindly for the 28 minutes it took to complete the first scrum in the Calcutta Cup.
Yeah, cheers, Al, thanks.
Alex Lowe, correspondent from The Times, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you. Steve, are we okay? Will's only been here 2 weeks, he's already hosting The Ruck.
I know, it hasn't happened before. I did 20 years before I was allowed to host.
Are they invented podcasts then?
No, there was no podcast. No, they had just general chit chat. To be fair, he's got off to a mediocre start, but he's got to get better now, hasn't he?
Yeah, well, yes.
It's a slightly lame start, I thought.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got plenty of time now to. Yeah, exactly. To improve. Yeah. We'll give him a go.
Yeah, he's got two more minutes before we check him out.
Well, gents, we were all in Edinburgh this weekend for Scotland's win against England. But before we get into the big stuff, just tell me how much you enjoyed being back covering a normal Six Nations weekend. We had the privilege, didn't we, of. I suppose, privilege or hell of covering the lockdown rugby, didn't we? We were lucky to go, but to me it just felt nice to be back among the fans and getting back to normal, didn't it, Alex?
Yeah, massively. I mean, there were 60-odd thousand there, and as we travelled up on Friday, there were cars and trains and planes full of travelling fans, and that's, as I sat down to write my preview for the weekend, that's what struck me. It was, you know, we went through last year's championship, which was on the field competitive, but just it was flat as an event, wasn't it? And just the festival, the carnival of the Six Nations, it really felt like it was back in full force. And it was lovely to, and we have the privilege of going to these games, and it was great to be there. And the atmosphere was raucous, and Murrayfield packed to the rafters again. Lovely to see, and it was good that at least one of our fellow writers really made the most of it. Probably my favourite story of the weekend was arriving at Murrayfield on Saturday, and saw one of the writers. I won't say who or where from.
The unnamed soldier.
Unnamed. And I said, "Oh, were we out last night?" He went, "Oh yeah, we went to the Gilly Do." I said, "Oh, where's that?" He said, "Oh, it's a bar in the middle of town. It's open till 6." I said, "Oh, fair play. What time did you leave?" 6. So he was back at full pelt, full speed ahead on a Six Nations weekend, and I bet he was not alone either.
Steve, when was your first Five Nations match? What year would that have been?
Well, I covered my first Five Nations game for the Sunday Times in 1984. That was the year I said that the Australian team that was coming over to England was the worst that's ever left their shores. In fact, they became the first ever to win the Grand Slam. So that was a slightly dodgy start.
How good was it to be back, though, Steve, and all the fans?
It's wonderful. And also, look, for a start, we haven't seen each other, sat down with each other for a beer for a long time. We managed that on Friday. It was lovely to see the fans, you know, people on the trains, planes, etc. It's just marvellous. I mean, Edinburgh is a magnificent venue. It really is. The press facilities are absolutely abject, but the rest of the stadium is fantastic. And the key, I felt, the tribute to Scottish rugby was Saturday evening when all work was done. We went to the normal Chinese restaurant and Stuart Barnes ordered a tandoori haggis as a special
fusion
tribute.
Fusion foods. That's
yeah, it
very
was
2022.
Tandoori haggis. Seriously.
Well, my favourite was I was on the train up to Edinburgh on Friday and there were a group of senior pros who got on at York, 14 lads from a rugby club, and they had the best picnic you've ever seen, with including little sliced up lemons for their gin and tonic and ice that lasted the whole journey. No idea how they did that. Bottles of Chablis. Two Gordons on the 11 a.m. Extraordinary stuff.
Do you know what? The Scottish game, you hear so many great stories. Like there was one about sort of 30 years ago where these four people went all the way up the M6 in their car on their way up to this pilgrimage. They broke down at Carlisle. The car couldn't be repaired. So they went into this pub in Carlisle and they were warmly welcomed. So now every year they go to Carlisle and they've been doing it for like 20 years. The four of them, they go in this pub, they meet all their mates and they watch the game there. And that's just part of the folklore of the whole thing.
Two years ago we got snowed in up there and most of us had to spend an extra night except for Lawrence, who paid £1,000 for a taxi back to London.
Well, it was great to be back, and before we get into the meat of it, let's run through what we're going to do today. We'll look back on the opening round of the 2022 Championship with wins for Ireland, Scotland and France. We'll cast our eyes towards next weekend, including a massive game in Paris between France and Ireland. France defence coach, we'll preview that one. Sean Edwards will join us, and we'll also round up the results in the Gallagher Premiership. Jess Hayden has the latest in the women's game as usual, and we will end with a god, goddess or devil of the week. But first, we'll get stuck into the opening round of the Six Nations, starting with that dramatic match at Murrayfield. Here are the thoughts of Eddie Jones and Gregor Townsend after that game.
We played well, mate. We set out to take the game to Scotland. We did that in the first half. We came in at half-time, but the points didn't show that. And then I thought our response in the first part of the second half was outstanding. You know, we were in a position to win the game. And sometimes, you know, you play well and you don't get the result. Tonight was an example of that.
We were against the wind in the first half and the conditions weren't great. I thought England played really well. So we had a lot of defending to do. And while at times we felt in control, England could easily have scored a try in that period. So to get in at half-time, having taken our opportunity with a try, we knew we could be playing much better and we'd have that wind advantage in the second half. With parts of the second half, we were able to play well, but it did come down to really fine margins.
So, gents, that was Gregor Townsend talking to Talk Sport, and he ended on the note of fine margins. How fine do we think they were, Alex?
Well, in the end, incredibly fine. England appealing for a scrum penalty to try and draw a game at Murrayfield. It shouldn't have been that fine from England's perspective, I don't believe. They were the better team for an hour. It took them 40 minutes to start translating that into points. Their third quarter, on the back of their mauling game, really defensive and attacking-wise, got them field position and they're 17-10 up. And at that point, they had control of the game. And in a split second, it changed. And Finn Russell's brilliance, Scotland's ability to sense a moment and seize it, changed the momentum back. There are so many strands to this about substitutions, about lack of England's inability to be clinical, and the issues they had attack-wise in the first half with not enough penetration, too much lateral. There's so much going on. It was a game where England had their most inexperienced starting 15 in the Six Nations under Eddie. They ended with a very experienced team. And a lot of those senior players were the ones who then made the mistakes. Horrible lack of execution, some questionable decisions. And that's just focusing on England. Scotland's defence was brilliant, I thought, Steve. They held England out at a point when England had most of the ball and most of the territory. Hamish Watson was just sensational, and they took their chances and won a tight game, and deservedly so, actually, because, as Ben Young said afterwards, if you can't transfer your dominance in terms of territory and possession into points, then you leave yourself open to what happened.
Steve, we should probably credit Scotland for the win. How impressed were you with them that they backed it up from last year?
I disagree with Alex that they weren't the better side, because I thought they were. And you've got to remember, until, say, 10 years ago, if you got 84% possession and 74% territory, etc., you always won the game.
Yeah.
No, that doesn't give you any guarantees whatsoever.
No, that's true.
Didn't give you any guarantees, and I thought Scotland were the better team in attack. I thought they had more ideas. I suspected that they would win before the Luke Cowan-Dickey stuff. And the thing is, guys, unless you're playing Italy, in every international match, it's always going to be tight. It's always going to be tight. And the art of getting out of international matches, this is why I keep saying, they've got to go for the Grand Slam. There's an art of getting out of these games. And England don't have it. And yet again, there's no Grand Slam. Yet again, as we had in the World Cup final, as we had against Wales last year, Ireland the year before, we could have done this, the ref could have done this, we shouldn't have done that. They bloody well didn't, and they lost. And Eddie Jones' career is slipping by. Our lives are slipping by, because we'd like to be covering a winning England team. There's not one. And there's not one because he picked too young a side, too inexperienced, and they could not get out of the match. Now, let's take the Joe Mahler incident. Joe Mahler can't throw in. What was Alex Dombrandt doing coming short inside the 5 metre channel? Joe Mahler almost had to throw the ball to him. Lots of stuff like that. They got what they deserved.
So
nothing.
We teed the start of this podcast up by talking about how good the fans were coming back. Do you feel like, you've covered England for a long time, this tournament for a long time,
yeah,
that England fans have sort of consistently been let down by their coaching? People have spent thousands of pounds getting up to Murrayfield. They're excited. And the preview to it is a lot of talk about 4 or 5 campaigns to the World Cup.
Yeah.
Lots of England fans would say to me, I don't care about the World Cup.
No, of course they don't.
Let's talk about the Six Nations. We're going to Murrayfield.
They want to... Look, do you know what? I'll give you an example. Wales won the Grand Slam under Warren Gatland in his first year. What year was that, Alex?
2008.
2008. Until then, you know, my two lads who then were in their teens had no idea that Wales were a big rugby nation. And they didn't want to know that Wales used to win it all in the 70s. Suddenly they realise that they are. Suddenly there's this great momentum. Suddenly the crowd comes back on board. Suddenly the actors want to be pictured with the team, and the Mannocks want to be pictured with the rugby team. That is what happens when you win the Grand Slam. You can wear a Grand Slam pullover. Wales used to have Grand Slam pullovers with the scores on, like Wales 28, England 3, and the people used to wear them in pubs.
They're like band tour dates.
Exactly. Now, since Clive Woodward stood down, probably including when he stood down in 2004, they keep on coming up short. Now, if they are Belgium, they could have these results. Even if they were Italy, even Scotland would like their results. But they're bloody well England, and they are not fulfilling all the money they spend, all the stuff, words we expel on them, they're not good enough to do it.
So my thing on that, Will, is that after the disaster of last year's Six Nations, that team had to change. And that the changes that were made, and I know Steve would disagree with a lot of them, I think they're a better team in the autumn than they were in the Six Nations. They were fresher with newer ideas, greater energy, greater variety of options in attack. The team that started the game at Murrayfield was young. They were missing some senior figures, Courtney Laws, just to name the most obvious. I think that they missed him. But they were winning the game. And I'm not saying that they were the better team overall, because over 80 minutes, they weren't, because they were horribly beaten up in that last 20. And then they lost their accuracy and their composure over an hour, not the way that we would have expected them to put themselves into a winning position, but they did do over the course of an hour, over the course of 80, Scotland absolutely were the deserved winners. I think that England had to make those changes. a year ago. They've left themselves with a young team. There's still lots of questionable selections and omissions. But actually, as it happened, a lot of the mistakes that were made in that last quarter when Scotland almost closed the game out, they had the penalty under the sticks, which would have been a six-point advantage. And then the penalty got reversed because of the neck roll on Tom Curry. That gave England a window. And they decided not to go for the posts, team decision. I admired the boldness. It was probably
would
not
a tough
the,
kick, that, wouldn't it?
It would have been Daly, a longer probably. Kick for Daly in tricky-ish conditions. So they went for touch. I don't hate that decision. But I do hate that George Ford took that kick and went 10 metres and Slade didn't take it with his left foot into the 22, which is a classic Henry Slade decision.
He does affect it all the time, doesn't he?
The knock-on of that is that because of the field position, Scotland can challenge in the air and they stole the line out. If it's in the 22, Scotland don't challenge in the air, they've got field position. That's a senior player with a poor kick, and then the Saracens collection had the ball stolen at the line out, and then of course you've got the mucked final play which involves senior players. And so it wasn't the kids that let them down, Steve. I guess that's what I've in a very long winded way tried to say.
Just on the profligacy, I guess, of the England attack. I was just looking, I rewatched the game on Sunday on the way back and made a few notes. And loads of these things are really avoidable skill errors. So the first minute, Ben Youngs sends a long box kick that gets marked immediately into the 22, no momentum. The ninth minute, Luke Cowan-Dickey, he's in a pod trying to receive the ball, doesn't realise it's coming to him, knocks it on, turns over the ball. Then you've got the 18th minute, they were slow on... Sorry, the 10th minute, they're slow on the line out for Ben White's try. They got outfoxed there completely. 20th minute, Luke Cowan-Dickey kicks away, penalty advantage, the ball goes dead into the left-hand corner, turnover again. 27th minute, wasted attack by Max Maynard's kicking into the dead ball area again. 30th minute, Marcus Smith kicking a long cross kick over to Henry Slade's head. 37th minute, Sam Simmons makes a really nice break in the sort of 12 channel, and then Max Malins gets done for sealing off. They've no momentum there. There was also Elliot Daly in the 13 channel with a man outside. He kicks it. And that's, I think the stat was Scotland spent 54 seconds in England's 22, and England was over 2.5 minutes and scored one try.
So we've talked a lot about England here. That sealing off thing was interesting because it happened to both teams and it did kill some momentum for both sides. I remember one counter from Van der Merwe from his own 22. Stuart Hogg comes in over the top. There's no one competing for it. Penalised. It killed the momentum. But England didn't have enough penetration, enough direction because of the selections they made, i.e. no one holding the defence running straight. But we've got to talk about Scotland as well.
Like, absolutely, yeah.
Steve Tandy's defence that he's put in place is outstanding. I thought Hamish Watson and Matt Fagerson in the back row were just another level. Watson didn't miss a tackle. He not only didn't miss them, there are tackles.
He hasn't for 2 years.
He hasn't missed one for 2 years in the Six Nations. But there are tackles and there are tackles. Like, he's not just kind of passively accepting someone running at him. He is making dominant hits.
Yeah.
And not only that, if you watch it, some of those incidents closely, some of those collisions closely, it takes them a second or two to even bring the guy down, and that's deliberate. He's slowing everything down. There was a 13-second ruck at one point. I mean, it's like they were slowing everything down, and that's part of the reason why England were lateral.
Yeah.
Partly England's fault, but they were dictating those terms. So, you know, they were very comfortable in their own half because I thought they were defending brilliantly.
I totally agree with that. But the thing is, you know, I just don't ever get these selections. Before the game, we all thought, blimey, poor old Henry Slade in the centre. He really outweighed. He's really going to have to work to get over the advantage line. What happened? He was totally outweighed and had to work to get over the advantage line. He was beasting the ball up, and he'd come up like a diver who just ran out of air. So he was staggering around like that. Well, we knew that was going to happen. And Mark Atkinson may not be too laggy, but he's a much better player as 12 than that. And he's the second best player in the position in the Premiership, and he should have started just to take them over the advantage line. And then old flanker, then he's not in such a good position. So I just felt sorry for him.
They used Sam Simmons there quite a bit, didn't they? There was a lot of fluid position switching, and Simmons was being used a lot at 12 to try and provide that.
And he did all right, actually.
But there are subtleties, isn't there? I mean, I can't ever say I played at inside centre, but there are angles, aren't there? There are instincts which are slightly different. It's not just about power; it's about footwork. It's about angles of running.
I
thought Sam Simmons did very well, but what played out in the attack was what we expected. And you know, I think on Tuesday last week I had to pick my team to play that game, and it felt to me that Smith, Atkinson, Slade was the best balance they could have had. Robust defensively. Atkinson, as you said, Steve, is the second best in that position. You know, I think Fowler doesn't play that position in the Premiership. But if England want Fowler to play there, then and he's not available, then Atkinson is the best option, I would say, other than Lazowski, but he's not in the squad.
Different story there, yeah.
I'd have Lazowski in that squad all day long, but Atkinson should have played, and he should play this weekend in Rome.
I think you said, or we both said, look, we're concentrating a bit on England here. I just think that Finn Russell now, since he came back into the team after his probably something he had to do with Greg, I had a bit of a barney with him and all that, and he missed. I just think the man has got this aura around him. He's not infallible, but you know, my God, when it came down to it, those two beautiful diagonal kicks, and I have to say that Scotland are. They're not essentially a confident side because they've had so many games where they've lost those. I think the edge has been given to them by Finn Russell. I just think he's such a confident guy. I think that Ali Price is good at scrum half. Mm. And let's be fair, the way they took that try from George Turner's quick throw, the way they
really
took
clever.
That try was just really, really clinical. Now, if England had had two moments of such... clinical finishing, they would have won the game.
Mm. Yeah, and it is. There are millions of ways to win a rugby match, and very strong defence, being comfortable in your own half. You know, England felt, and rightly so, that they should have done more. They should have converted that pressure into points. They should have done, because if you're in that position, that's what you should do. But Scotland won the game in a different way. They defended, they stopped that from happening, and then England had turned the screw on them in the third quarter, and Russell was like, I'm not doing that. But that try, that's what I meant. They sensed their opportunities and they were clinical when they took them. So their first try wasn't just well executed, was it, Steve? But it was well thought out. It was planned. Yeah. George Turner was hanging in the backfield because of the field position. They knew England would kick to touch. Kick to touch means they're ready to go, and it wasn't a quick line out, but it was a quickly taken one. Soon as they were in a position where they were allowed to take a formed line out. They did, and they caught England napping. Brilliant. And then those two kicks, cross kicks, exposed a narrow England defence. They all rushed one side. Marchand had to come over. And then the second one back towards Darcy Graham, which Callum Dickey knocked on, was brilliant. And for me, only bettered by the kind of impudence almost of the grubber kick he put into the 22 3 minutes later, in the knowledge that England didn't have a hooker on the field, and he gives them a 5 metre line out and says, basically, you either make a permanent sub, bring on Jamie George, knowing that in 5 minutes' time you'll have two hookers on the field, or you leave Joe Marler to take the line out 5 metres out. I mean, I love that kind of ramming that reading of the game and understanding. Of the opportunities,
it's sort of quarterback stuff, isn't it?
Brilliant, brilliant.
The one thing I think is really creditable with Scotland is it seems like their key game managers are really relaxed, calm, cool-headed. And also, so if you look at Ali Price, Finn Russell, really great mates, and same with Hogg at the back, they are the spine of the back line, and they're cool-headed, chilled-out lads off the field. They're not too... crazily overly emotional, and I think it really shows that they don't panic, whereas in previous years there was a series of years where Scotland had horrendous white line fever, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, there was a
about
time
10
when,
years ago.
There was a time when Gregor Townsend was the only person playing behind the scrum who was remotely of the and all that. No, so you're dead right. And that's why I say about Will, about Finn Russell, I just think he's got this aura about him, you know, he's untouchable.
I agree. And there's an attitude about it. And I tried to reflect it in what I wrote today, that England go 17-10 up, 63 minutes, and they make four changes. Now, it's impossible to say whether causation or correlation, you know, George Ford didn't touch the ball, as you pointed out, Will, in open field for 15 minutes when he came on. So did it matter who was at fly half?
It was a kickoff and a kick to touch with his touches did before the final play.
Who was at fly half? That's not the point I'm making. Like, 63 minutes, the message that sent was, right,
we're closing,
we've got
this.
A lead.
Yeah.
We've done our bit. We've got this game. We're now going to shut it down. And that's what I tried to reflect in what I wrote today, that if you're Finn Russell with Finn Russell's mindset, you're like,
watch this.
What? How, you know, almost offended by that.
Yeah.
There was a psychology about it as well, because it all happened at once.
Mm.
You know, England take the lead, a 7-point lead. They take off four players, including someone like Ludlam, who I thought had a really, really strong game, carrying probably the best carry of the day. And within 6 minutes, Scott Russell himself has gone and created a try and then created the penalty with that kick into touch.
When Smith went off, I did object to, and like my colleague, my tandoori-eating colleague Barnes, what I was really disappointed with, I think George Ford's a great player, I was really disappointed at the two penalty kicks they had to touch, they didn't give to Henry Slade to boom them down there, because George really, people think, God, we're going to be near our own line here. He didn't really go for it. He went for safety. Mm. And that really kind of almost, that dulled the England edge for me.
Well, was that because the passage before Smith went off, he'd gone for it into the corner and overcooked it and went long.
Mm.
Mm. And actually, he then redeemed himself because the ball came back to him and he put up a perfect...
Yes, he did, yeah.
...up and under, which fell just outside the 22. Finn Russell spilled it. Led to a scrum, which ended up leading to the penalty that put England 7 points ahead.
Mm.
So, but I wonder whether in the coach's box they went, he's pushing the envelope. He's taking too many risks in a tight game. We need to pull back from that. And I don't know whether that psychology then was then brought onto the field so that Ford wasn't aiming for the 22. He was aiming just for safety, but safety. It wasn't safe in the end because you open yourselves up to be challenged in the air, and then there's no guarantee the ball's going to be stolen. But if you kick it into 22, as Slade does all the time, it never is.
So in a second, I'll get you guys to sort of look forward to the next round and where both sides go from here. But I just wanted to pay a little tribute to Steve Tandy. And today, we're recording this on Monday, and I'm bringing out a new column actually for digital subscribers to the Times.
So he's come in, he's got
a column.
And he's hosting the Ruck.
Yeah, he's paying us to do it though, the column.
Oh, okay.
But we've cleverly named it The Mall, so on a Monday you can ruck a mall with the Times. So there we go.
Okay,
and
right,
it's very clever, Steve.
Very good.
And we've got the scrum on Saturdays as well. The set piece all covered.
And we got the punch up on Thursday.
No back play whatsoever.
The finishers are coming on the weekend.
The back play 2 a.m. next Thursday.
But no, the statistical deep dive I've done on Steve Tandy just is trying to show how much of an impact he's had on the Scottish defence. And the remarkable thing about it is that if you include all test matches since he started coaching Scotland's defence, the only two sides that have conceded fewer points per game than Scotland are New Zealand and Ireland. So Ireland is 16.2 per match, New Zealand 16.7, Scotland 16.9. I mean, Italy's the last at 38, but we'll ignore them. Mm. And in the Six Nations, they've 15 points per game, which is the best of any team, and they make 90% of their tackles, which is the best of any team in the world since he started. So, I mean, that is an extraordinary impact from Steve Tandy, who 7 or 8 years ago was at the Ospreys with Alan Wynne-Jones and Dustin Tipperick and those guys, kind of left petered out a little bit, went to Australia. Yeah. But he's had an amazing impact, Steve, hasn't he?
Well, look, I'll tell you what, those quotes are excellent. And those stats are excellent. Some stats a little bit more significant than less significant than we think, but that is a very, very significant stat. It really is. And just shows he's really sorted them out down there. And what a choice, because he's not an obvious choice to be the Scottish defence coach, is he? Mm. And fair play to him. I mean, those are amazing stats.
So, Alex,
mind you, Wales will probably score 14 tries on Saturday. No, but
let's talk about Wales. They're in a bit of disarray, really, after that result. Yeah. And we had Steve James in the Times today saying it kind of tees up a wider problem in the Welsh game, where the regional teams aren't winning. The national team got beaten up. I mean, they've lost in Ireland before, but this kind of looked like it was pointing to a wider problem with Welsh rugby.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to remember that the team that won the Six Nations last year has been decimated by... I mean, they've lost a lot of senior players.
700-odd caps worth, yeah.
Of Alan Wynn and Jonathan Davis and George North, whole back row.
Tipperick, Navidi, Halfpenny, you know that, yeah. Lydia.
So... in terms of where they are right now, this is the best they're going to get. And they are fine. They do have some exciting... I mean, Tane Basham, I think. I love watching Tane Basham. I hadn't seen him play until that All Blacks game in the autumn. I think he's brilliant. And Ellis Jenkins, same. I really like him. And Wainwright, very, very good player. But what this show... But there are all of those players who they're missing, they'd make the World Cup. Mm. And they probably will still make the World Cup. But they won't really be playing for Wales for 4 years, and so this is just a peek into the future of where Wales are. And Steve James and Hugh Jonesy and Mark Evans, who's been on this pod talking about Wales and the structure of Wales, know way more than I do. But these are worrying signposts for me for Wales. Like the Wales under 20s shipped 50 points on
Friday, yeah.
On Friday night. I think they lost 50-odd-3 to Ireland. The combined scores in those two games should send shockwaves, because the issue below the Wales team is now being reflected in the Wales team.
One of these things, I always got into terrible trouble for saying these things, but now and again I think that for Wales to win a game against Scotland will do them more long-term harm than if they lose it. Because if they do win, all the local pompous rugby officials with the game, or they think the game is in their pocket from the tiny clubs, they'll all be saying, oh, don't worry, we're all right, we've just beaten Scotland, we'll beat England at Twickenham, which they won't. I think it's better if Wales don't beat Scotland. I think they're in terrible straits. I think, actually, you've got to remember, they still had more caps than Ireland on the weekend.
It was a remarkable stat, wasn't it?
I just don't think that... You take the front row now. Ireland have got six front rowers who could play international rugby. Mm. Wales have got one. Thomas Francis is the only man who can hold a scrum just about. He's not tied furlong.
Wynn Jones is on the line to talk.
Yeah, he's okay. I'd just like to see him have a bit of a revival now. But, you know, what you've got... Then you've got Scotland bringing on two big South Africans who made a big difference. And Wales has not got no scrummagers. You're either a live wire prop getting round in the loose, or you're a scrummager, but you've got to be both these days. And they're really short. I think Adam Beard is the only forward coming through who I really like, with Basham, of course, as Alex says. Dan Bigg is really on his own there and is going to take stick. And I just hope, for the Scottish sake, that Scotland do not give Wales any credence at all. I hope they go out there, smash them from the start, which they didn't do against England, get ahead and confirm their breakthrough. And I think that in the long run, that will be better for Wales.
If you look across the Six Nations, Ben Darwin, former Australia prop who works in analytics now, he's big. What he studies really is cohesion in teams. Mm. And what Wales have always had, whether the regions have won or not, when they come into camp, it's the same group. Mm. They have a cohesion that they perform often above the sum of their parts. If you look at across the Six Nations, if Scotland have cohesion in their team, they know how they play and they know what they stand for. Ireland have built that.
Can't get more cohesion than having the whole Leinster team plus a couple of others.
Exactly,
yeah.
But what they've done is they've built it in a different way under Farrell. It wasn't easy initially to move away from what Joe Schmidt wanted them to do, but they've got the cohesion and they're doing it. And France, who have often been sort of the least cohesive team in a lot of ways. Speak to Sean. He's been critical to that.
Yeah.
Because he's built that foundation in defence where they have a different identity
collective
to where they were.
Collective purpose, isn't it?
In defence. And you look at Wales don't have it now. And England at the moment, that's what they're trying to get. I don't think they do have it.
I think they've probably got the players, but they don't have that cohesion. I think England have got the players, but they don't have that cohesion.
That's what I'm saying. That's exactly what they're trying to build.
So, right, lads, with Ireland winning well, France getting there and winning well eventually, we're set up for the mouth-watering game of the tournament, aren't we, France-Ireland? I think it's good to get a bit of insight, isn't it, from the French camp? So let's go down to Marc Houssaye, where we're talking to Sean Edwards, their legendary defence coach.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So we're now with France defence coach Sean Edwards. You had your good win over Italy on the weekend, Sean. Congrats on that. How pleased were you after it? I saw Antoine Dupont saying it was a little bit clumsy. What was your take on the victory?
Well, I thought I was pleased with how we played because we had virtually zero preparation. The reason being, not zero preparation, disrupted preparation, because the first week, a lot of the lads were away with COVID in the two-week prep building up to it. And then the second week, the wind in the south of France was just so strong that you could hardly practice. Anyway, so we went in the similar team we had against New Zealand and started off slowly, obviously, but we built our way into the game and ended up in pretty good form by the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, Fabien Galthié wasn't at the game because he had COVID, wasn't he? How was that dealing without him and who was sort of running the show? Was it Rafa Ibanez?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a smooth process, you know. Rafa was in charge and obviously we were all in charge of our various parts of the game. So, you know, it wasn't too bad, but it's always nice having Fabien there because he's a real student of the game and... you know, he's pretty clued up in both attack and defence. Well, he's very, very clued up in both aspects, really.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about Gabin Villiers? Obviously, he scored a hat-trick and has come from the Sevens game. What can you give us a bit of insight about him?
He's one tough hombre. That's probably the best thing I could explain him. He doesn't look like he's, an international rugby player. It probably doesn't run like his Luke Lacken is last of play, but boy, can he play. On both sides of the ball, in the defence and the attack, he's incredibly brave, very, very powerful for a relatively small man. Nothing seems to faze him. And it's great that, he wasn't like a superstar when he was young or anything like that. He's come through the spurious ranks, played second division rugby, I believe, and then sevens, and he's ended up playing and being a vital member of the L'Equipe de France, as it's called over here. Mm. And I think that's great for young lads to use him as an example. And like you said, he's not that big, but boy, is he powerful. And he's a very impressive player.
Sean, it's Jonesy here. I know wherever you've been in your career, right from the start at Wigan, you've always been under a certain amount of pressure to perform as one of the star players, and now one of the best known coaches in the game. This season, the expectation on France is enormous, and especially then going into the World Cup. Are you feeling that a bit, or you just basically kept it out of your mind as usual?
Well, like you say, I've been used to it all my life, so not being under pressure would be unusual for me.
Okay, and the, I mean, you still...
I was not under pressure. I was out of the game for a year and a half when I retired from playing.
Yeah.
And Hal after my day was going for a newspaper shop, and because I had a lot of injuries, and you know, which I need to recover from, etc. And I didn't enjoy having no pressure at all.
No, sure. Okay. It was better having none. It just seems to me that from where we sit, and I'm sure it was the same for you before you went over, it's such a kind of glamorous existence over there. I mean, I know you guys are all working your nuts off, but are you still enjoying it as much as you did?
Have you been to Marcus's, mate?
Yes, I have, yeah. All right, maybe not.
Still a bit of a spit and sawdust place, but we like it. It's a good training centre. It's got the basics, that what everything you need. The gym's okay. The pitch is a lot better now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we kind of like it. We just trained at an army camp for 2 weeks. So, yeah, and that was the normal army camp. It was a French Foreign Legion where I'm told, you know, the lads who... life's not too great. They go to the French Foreign Legion and they get a second chance at life. And so,
okay.
Glamorous? I wouldn't call that glamorous, no.
I'll take back that word then. Take back that word. Just a couple of one player I wanted to your opinion on, and that's Wauke. Not really well known over here, but looks like one of these sort of great French forwards who can do almost everything. Is that how you see him? And is he okay in defence?
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously an excellent line-up forward, and he's a player who, the first time I kind of set eyes on him, I thought that this kid could be special. He could play second row or back row, both sides of the back row. You know, awesome in the line-up. Very, very mobile. And I think he's improving his offloading game. He's probably work on was his defence, but he's concentrating on that and working very, very hard. And he's a great lad to be around as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sean, maybe 20 years or so ago, there was a lot of talk that the Six Nations should always end with England-France because it was always going to be the title decider. The folly of that has been proven many times over, and probably never more so than this year, because you've got a game against Ireland next weekend, the two teams who beat the All Blacks in the autumn, which is enormous as a fixture, and the game that's probably the most anticipated of any in this championship. How do you see this challenge against Andy Farrell's Ireland, who are improving rapidly, and you guys are doing the same?
Well, you know, obviously you get a number of crunch matches, and this is definitely one of them. I think we're playing against the form team in World Rugby at the moment. You know, I watched a bit of the game against Wales, and you know, the speed of the ruck ball, and you know, Mike Catt, they've got one of the best attack coaches in the world. So Mike's a guy I've competed against a number of times at club rugby and now international rugby, and I think he's one of the best tack coaches in the world, like I said. So, you know, I've definitely got my hands full this weekend. Limited preparation because it's a 6-day turnaround for us. But, you know, I think that is going to be one hell of a game.
And is stopping that attack the key to the game? Or I mean, you'll present a hell of a lot for them to stop as well.
Yeah, the thing about Alan, though, is to get the ball back off them. If you look at the stats of, particularly throughout the Six Nations campaigns they've won, you know, I know that was before Andy was there as head coach, but if you watch I've just watched the first half against the All Blacks, it's like 72% possession, 75% territory, and the All Black attack just couldn't get going because of this, you know, ability of theirs to keep hold of the ball. And we have to be incredibly disciplined around about, you know, the halfway line, because we do know that Ireland back themselves to play ball in hand rugby, and that's great to see teams, because obviously that's what you want to watch. But we have to be disciplined enough to go phase after phase after phase, and to be prepared to make over 200 tackles in one game.
Sean, there was a great stat that was in the Times today, and you mentioned it about the speed of the rucks. I think 71% of Ireland's rucks were recycled within 3 seconds or less against Wales.
Yeah. I'm telling you, some of them Wales lads are very, very good jacklers.
Mm.
Very, very good jacklers. So it's not as if they were playing against a team who were, how can I say, you know, who didn't have any open sides or didn't have any guys who were naturally good over the ball. A lot of them Welsh lads are very good over the ball, so that makes it even more an achievement by the Irish team to get such quick ball against a team historically who love to compete for the ball.
Yeah. In your Wales career, you often had Ireland's number. So what was the key then when you were with them to beating them and sort of setting up a defence to stop the attack?
Well, we didn't always beat them because I think we had a pretty equal sort of record in beating it, you know, in beating each other. But just the fact that you have to try to keep them out of the 22 is as simple as that.
Mm. And how much do you love competing with Andy Farrell as well?
And it's very, very difficult to do to keep them out of your 22 because, you know, obviously, and like you say, the structure that they have is very, very well drilled by Mike Catt, as you'd expect, as I'm repeating myself, because he's a great coach. Mm. And we have to be clever in the way that we slow the ball up and try to win collisions.
Mm. You enjoy the competition against Andy as well? It's gone back a long way, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's of the highest order whenever it's against Faz. You know, he was a great, great player, one of the greats of Wigan, we believe. And he's gone on to be a top, top, top coach. And that didn't surprise me one bit because he's always been a high-class operator.
Awesome, Sean. Well, we're all really looking forward to that game.
Thank you.
A great insight there from Sean Edwards, the defence coach. Interesting stuff about the French Foreign Legion there. That sounds right up his street, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, glamour is not... glamour is nothing that... It's not something that ever attracts Sean. He'll love Marcoussis because it's isolated and they can work hard. And it actually plays to the theme that we were talking about earlier, doesn't it? That France spending 2 weeks at a French Foreign Legion camp, you know, that is where they're instilling the foundation stones. That's where they're building that cohesion and that toughness. And they have this wonderful generation of players. I mean, Steve, you asked him about Cameron Wauke, just sort of the latest to... And Villiers, you know, these guys are the... Are megastars, and I wouldn't be surprised if someone like Cameron Wauke ends up being player of the championship.
Quick verdict, Steve, France, Ireland?
Just looking forward to it so much, so much. Look, I just think that France are, if they're absolutely flat out and they go for it, I think they can. They're a great side. I fancy Ireland by one score. I really do fancy Ireland in it.
And that would tee them up for a run-in, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, some people say that they were available at 5-1 for the championship.
Some clever people put some dosh on it as well.
I wouldn't know about that, but I just think they got a great chance. I think they're potentially a great side. They'll have Henshaw back, I think, in the centre. Again, I mean, Henshaw Ringrose against Ficou and Donty. I mean, blimey, you'd pay money for that alone.
Yeah, and Cyril Bailly against Furlong.
Oh,
those
wow.
Two front rows, awesome. Man. I mean,
unbelievable.
Yeah, Porter. Kelleher, Furlong
Cousin
against
Ronan.
against those the French unit. That's fireworks.
Could be epic.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Let's take off the brake foot and let's go. For
yeah.
It.
Yeah. And the last time that we went there, we didn't go there. I think we were sitting in Rome. But Johnny Sexton's 42-meter drop goal that finished it. So maybe we could get a spectacular finish like that again. That'd be pretty cool.
I think. I mean, I wrestled with it and went with France as my Six Nations winners just over Ireland.
Mm.
It's one of those that if the game was in Dublin, I might have slightly edged Ireland. It's if Ireland could go out there and win it, what an epic!
Oh, let's be fair. You know, we're getting stuck into the technical side of it here. What a time it's been for the Six Nations. You know,
brilliant.
Great first weekend, great second weekend coming up, and national terrestrial television new magazine programme were right in prime time yesterday.
Mm.
I mean, blimey, you know, and which I thought was quite good. I thought Ugo did it really well, and it's the great days of the Six Nations, really. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. And I saw actually as well that France had record viewers on telly as well, so they're getting it back together as well. But we'd probably leave Italy, England for a prediction, because that's going to be Italy's 34th defeat in a row, isn't it? Likely.
It is. I'll say is, look, England have got three problem positions, OK? They've got to give Mark Atkinson a go at 12. They must do, because they've got to, just in case Tuilagi doesn't come back. And I would play the next choice outside the squad at tight end prop and lock. They're going to need a new lock just in case Johnny of Exeter doesn't get back. And the tight end prop backup is really poor, as is the lock backup.
Who would they pick? Joe Hayes
probably, and anyone who would be the next lock outside the squad.
Launchbury,
I might even give Joe Launchbury a go, because Charlie Yields for me is not cut it as a starter or a replacement. I'd like to see Atkinson, definitely. I'd like to see a couple of big young bulls given their chance up front.
And Steve's already given his Wales-Scotland verdict, but Alex, what do you think on that
one? Scotland to win down there and consolidate a really outstanding win for them at Murrayfield. Is it three wins and a draw from the last five cuts for Scotland? So
yeah,
no,
but
food.
They haven't won in Cardiff since 2002. They did win in Llanelli.
Oh, more history.
With no fans.
Them.
Bloody hell.
But they're ticking off a few records, aren't they?
Yeah.
Right, so that's our Six Nations Round 1 verdict signed, sealed and delivered. Definitive as always. And next we're going to look at a little bit of the Premiership and then round up with our Goddess or Goddess of the Week. So, lads, while we were all up at Murrayfield, there was a round of Premiership rugby games. Gloucester beat London Irish 24-7, Bristol 37, Newcastle 21. Wasps stealing one from Exeter, 27-26. A dog grew in the very, 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 very last minute. Leicester 36, Worcester 16. Saracens had their second big win over Bath of the season, 40-3. And Sale thrashed Harlequins 36-14 at home. Steve, you saw a little bit of that last one.
Yeah, I did.
Quick verdict on that.
Well, two things. First of all, I saw most of the Wasps exit the game. Replay, and Wasps were dead and buried. They were miles back, and Exeter were driving and close range driving and scoring, and my goodness, Wasps came back, and it just shows the guts of this team. Odogwu, who actually looks a bigger bloke than when he went out of the game, he looked fairly hefty, but can still move. Scored two nice tries, but their passion for it was tremendous. And look, an away win when you're 19 points down at Exeter is really something. Really something. And also Sale just looks to me, I stand to be corrected, but they have finally found it. Mm. You know, I mean, I know Quint was short of players, but the Faf was back, came on and looked exactly like Faf does. And Manu Tuilagi came on and looked exactly like Manu does. He wasn't so great in attack, but in defence he was absolutely ferocious.
Belted Esterhazen straight
off
the bat, didn't he?
And actually, every match I could see, there was a big crowd in the background, so... You know, fans of the Premiership, they're sticking with it. And, you know, as soon as we come out, the internationals will be straight back in.
Right, so next up on the podcast, we'll have Jessica Hayden's roundup of everything that's going on in the women's game.
The headline fixture of round 13 in the Premier 15s was the Saracens versus Harlequins derby. The two teams have played in every Premier 15s final so far, and they're incredibly close in performance. At Twickenham Steep, Saracens were without two key players as both Poppy Cleal and Zoe Harrison were unavailable. But despite Harlequins pulling away at the start of the match, the game finished with Saracens ahead 22-8, which was a huge win to maintain their position at the top of the Premier 15s table. Saracens are 7 points clear at the top with just 5 regular season games remaining, almost confirming their place in the top 4 playoffs. England head coach Simon Middleton would have been pleased with the performances of some of his players, particularly Harlequins hooker Amy Cocaine and Saracens fly half Holly Aitchison, who will now have a couple of injury concerns heading into the Women's Six Nations, which begins at the end of March. Harlequins Jess Breach and Saracens Hannah Botterman both left the pitch with injuries that could see them miss the tournament. For Breach, this shoulder injury will be particularly upsetting as she only returned to rugby in December after breaking her back in training. Elsewhere, Worcester Warriors narrowly lost out to second in the table Bristol Bears. Exeter Chiefs bounced back from a disappointing performance against Wasps in the previous round to secure a bonus point win against Gloucester Hartbury, with Exeter's Kate Zachary crossing over 3 times in the 36-32 win. Finally, Wasps move within 1 point of the top four with a 46-0 defeat of DMP Durham Sharks. As we near the end of the season and the top four places become increasingly important, it feels worth reminding you of who the top four currently are. So it's Saracens, Bristol, Exeter and Harlequins. And the scores from round 13 are Harlequins 8, Saracens 22, Bristol Bears 12, Worcester Warriors 10, Gloucester Hartbury 32, Exeter Chiefs 36, Sale Sharks 3, Loughborough Lightning 32, and finally DMP Durham Sharks 0, Wasps 46.
Okay, to finish up, Lance, plenty going on in this podcast, but we must have your god, goddess, devil of the week. Who should we start with? Steve, are you ready? Are you primed?
I am ready, and it's a saintly figure, not a devil figure. My god of the week, no question, is George Turner of Scotland. Talk about unheralded. George, they had two line-outs near their own line, within 5 metres. Of their own line, which puts the England spoilers really close to the action. Turner unveiled the two best line-out throws I've ever seen. When you're throwing long to your own backs over the line-out, you're almost bound to loft it. But he didn't actually loft it. It just went wham, like that, head just over head height, straight to the Scot who was going to clear it, with England nowhere near. He did it twice, and I just think that was supremely skillful. And up there with Patrick Mahomes as a deliverer of the pass, even though he didn't have quite the same athleticism. But he did. And I think he also played a great part in that. We were talking earlier, that he kept out the way till that quick lineup, then suddenly went like that. My great friend Nigel Botherway rang me, said that was a quick line-out, you couldn't do that. Well, no, it wasn't. It was a quickly thrown in ball to a proper line-out. That's what it was. I just think Turner was my god of the week. I thought it was absolutely tremendous.
Alex, halo, horns, where are we going?
A halo for the member of the media who, as I mentioned at the start, decided to invest himself so heavily in the return of the festive spirit of the Six Nations that he was out till 6 a.m. on the day of the game. Love that.
Who was it? Name the newspaper.
It was
Right, okay.
Oh, I'm breaking up, sorry.
And give a devil to the person at the SRU who keeps insisting on people calling it BT Murrayfield but laying on the worst internet in the media centre
you could
possibly find in a Six Nations stadium.
Yeah.
The irony being that I tried to tweet that at halftime. And it took 10 minutes for the tweet to go.
No bandwidth.
But I mean, I can't look beyond. There's so many from this weekend. But Finn Russell for just taking it on and sensing the moment, and executing it brilliantly.
So on my first podcast, we had a Wasps triple, and I think we're going to get a Scotland triple on this one. So as outlaid by my stats earlier, I think I'm going to give mine to Steve Tandy. Mm. What a job he's done.
Mm, good one.
So a Scottish triple header, and the final stat to finish it off, the last time they won back-to-back Calcutta Cups, how did they finish? 84? Grand Slam.
Grand Slam.
Nothing can go wrong from here, Scotland. Perfect. Right, everyone, that has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. We'll be here every week, of course, throughout the season, bringing you the latest discussion and insight. So follow or subscribe from wherever you get your podcast from. See you next week, everyone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.